Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Well, you know what? It is a journey of aging, as we say on The Rad Life, and anybody who had the fortune or misfortune, whichever way you want to look at
to
it.
To tune in at the right time.
To tune in at the right time just before the show. Now also realizes that we are so considerate of our guests that we make sure they know exactly where the bathrooms are before they start.
And the whole world.
And then as well as sharing that information.
Can we wait
with
a minute? Because I got to go to the bathroom now.
No, Paul, you can't go to the bathroom. You got to hold it. And the reason why is because you need to be punished. Aren't you Catholic?
Yes.
Catholic, right?
I'm Catholic.
Okay, you will be punished. You will pay penance for that mistake.
Pay penance. Okay.
So what happened, for anybody who's listening, is... I apologize for the too much information portion of the show earlier.
Because, what the heck? Let it all hang
out. No, we're not going there. Okay, I can't believe you even just said that, right? But Paul actually had the mics on, and this is live radio. This is what happens.
We're racing to get everybody in here. We're late.
This is how the sausage is made, okay? We're racing to get everybody in.
We're late.
And we're running a little late, as usual. And then here we are. And the mics are on.
Somebody
we're having an in-depth conversation about the location of the bathrooms. But with that being said, were you able to find them, Tracy?
I was able to find them.
And that was a good
Very
thing.
Very explicit direction.
Very explicit direction.
And are you set to go now? Are we all set?
Are we set to go? I don't know, man. Can I grill you a little bit more about that? Ladies and gentlemen, can I get some applause for our technician, par none, Paul Roberts?
Okay, sorry.
That's probably more appropriate. So here's the whole thing that you should be getting out of this is the fact that you should tune in always at 12 o'clock,
yes,
regardless whether the show is on or not, because you just never know what bloopers you're going to pick up on added value.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So with that being said.
How are we going to top that now? Whatever she's going to talk about, we can't top that.
I know
now.
Anything I say is not going to be close to that.
You know what? I bet you we will do just
Think
fine.
So? Okay.
Yes. Yes. We always do, right, on this show.
Yes,
people are like, I don't know why I'm tuning in to
you. Usually find a way to tie it into aging. I don't know how you're going to tie this
well,
into aging.
Well, because it is a journey of aging, we say on the show. And it's one of the very critical things when you get older.
That's true.
Is in all cases, you always need to know where the facilities are, right?
We have to plan our trips now with
that
figuring
is way,
out how
okay,
many bathrooms are along
old man.
The way.
Too much information, old man. Okay. Okay. So anyway, we actually have a very special guest in the show today. On the show today, and when I met this lady, because of a lot of people that know that I've been involved in nonprofits for a very long time.
You never talk about that.
Because it's a love-hate relationship with nonprofits. And she's laughing and she knows exactly what I'm talking about. Okay. But I've served on some boards. You know, I've served on a board of a nonprofit that's part of a national network called Rebuilding Together on their Orange County board for, 7 years, I think it was. And then we did not survive the downturn of the economy, unfortunately. We were part of a network of 200 locations. There's a great chapter out of Long Beach that's still operating. I'm not sure. There might be one in San Diego still. That was sort of a Habitat for Humanity type, nonprofit where we did remodels versus new construction. And anyway, long story short, we did that before Habitat started doing that, and then Habitat kind of got into that when the economy went down. Because resources got a little bit more finite.
They stole your act. Huh?
Well, it started off being Christmas in July, and then became Rebuilding Together. Anyway, it was a part for me to give back in something that was sort of related to my 9-to-5 bread and butter, kind of the interior design and construction business. I also have been on the San Clemente Historical Society board for 14 years, going on 15, served in all capacities. I tend to gravitate. Tomorrow, I want to give a shout-out, actually, tomorrow morning. Taylor Moons, who basically started the 100 Companies That Care OC chapter, we're having a meeting. I've had him on the show before. We're having a meeting. So being involved in the nonprofit business for at least almost two decades, in different capacities, volunteering, believing firmly that volunteering, giving back is mm-hmm. part that feeds your soul that no amount of money or paycheck is ever going to give you, right? And I encourage that at every turn, regardless of your age, to look for opportunities that are appropriate to volunteer and get involved in your immediate communities or further on things that are, you know, we are better together. We really are better together. And selfishly, it will reward you in ways that you would never even imagine until mm-hmm. you do it, right? But with that being said, I also have a love-hate relationship with nonprofits, right? And I've seen how the sausage is made or not made. And I've seen some of the common problems and pitfalls and issues and struggles of nonprofits. And coming at it from a business-minded perspective in what else I do, I find that I wish nonprofits were run more like businesses. And some of the larger ones, obviously, that are massive infrastructures, they are. You know, a shout out to my friends Susan Kinney and Noel at the executive director at the Ronald McDonald House in Orange County. Great operation there. The people at Patriots and Paws. You know, there's a whole bunch of them out there, and I'm sure I'm, you know, Goodwill is another one that's great, right? But these organizations have a little bit more of a business acumen. I find that there's a lot of nonprofits that mean well, that are well-intentioned, that are basically out there, and they get a lot of people that volunteer, but then mm-hmm. they're missing these components of efficiency, qualification, you know. And at the end of the day, I'm sure we'll touch on some other ones, but I find that some repetitive problems, for example, are legal consultancy, and how do you pay for it? Do you have it built into your network or not? Fundraising, mm-hmm. big one, right? Grant writing, another one. You know, all the well-intentioned people sitting on the board, if you don't have the skill set and the nuances of knowing how to do grant writing, which is really a repetitive process, mm-hmm. and being set up for success in that, then you are likely to fail as a nonprofit.
Can I give you one more I see all the time sitting in this chair?
What is it?
Sustainability. Once the passion of once the founder leaves, is it still going to continue as the charity die off?
Well, so what you're talking about, though, and I would have said, when you said sustainability, I would have said sustainability in terms of funding and support and programs.
Yeah,
but what you brought up actually is a different one. You're saying sustainability from a position of passion and mission. Right, which is actually critical difference between what I was thinking when you said sustainability. So with that, without further ado, I would like to introduce my guest, Tracy. Would you tell people about you and what you are currently doing? But then I want to go back and see what it is that you have been done in the past,
sure.
And how did you find yourself actually gravitating towards this? Because what you do, in my opinion, is so needed, right? And so important for nonprofits to embrace if they genuinely are interested in fulfillment of their mission.
Mm-hmm. So I own and manage Smart Start Evaluation and Research. The company is around 10 years old, and I acquired it within the last year and a half or so.
And let's give people the website right away.
Smart Start, SMARTSTART-ER.com.
So Smart Start. And then spelled out. No, you just spelled it out. So smartstart-er.com. So smartstart-er.com, and the ER stands for evaluation research.
Correct. .com.
So please go to that website and check out some of the stuff that's on there. We may not get a chance to cover it all. And then Tracy, tell people your name, your full name.
Tracy, my formal name?
Your former full name.
My formal
What's your middle name?
Tracy Malai Shirachi is my full entire legal name.
So Tracy Shirachi, and check out the website. And you bought the company.
Correct.
Okay. Now, the company is based out of?
Orange County, Irvine, California. And we focus on providing evaluation services primarily to education institutions, nonprofit, mm-hmm. charitable nonprofits, mm-hmm. and government agencies.
And how long is it? You mentioned it, but how long has the company been around?
10 years.
10 years.
A little over 10 years.
And can I ask you one question?
Sure.
Can you put that in terms that I can understand? What does that mean that you do?
Well, you have to listen to the rest of the show.
I heard the words,
understand.
But I don't know what that means.
So be patient.
Do you need
to go to the bathroom?
I really, you know, when you talk about something long enough, how you can't
stop thinking about it. Or we can get the dictionary out. I think even the dictionary may not properly explain what we do.
If anybody would like to call in and explain to Paul what evaluation and research means, you're more than welcome to do
it. I just don't know in practical terms what that
means. Well,
if you asked me to do that job tomorrow, I wouldn't know what I'd
Well, before we get there, I'm curious. So, so
Maybe little, I don't know what little we background. Just kidding.
A little background on the company that you know has been around for 10 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was the impetus for starting it? Do you know?
Impetus is passion for education as well as evaluation. So a lot of it is PIs and professors who are submitting grants mm-hmm. for research purposes.
Who are PIs?
Yeah. PIs are usually the professors.
I mean, what's a PI? We don't know what a PI is.
Oh, principal investigator. Sorry. That's why I usually say professors because it's easy. People can usually identify with
investigator.
Specific professors.
Meaning they're about to approach something.
Do research on
something.
Right. So university professors primarily will submit grants, right, to fund their research. However, in the case where they're a STEM, so science, technology, engineering, or math professor, they're submitting grants to the government agencies, and that government agency as a funder is requiring an evaluator to measure the outcomes of that research being shared with usually students, like K through 12 students, for instance.
So you're an independent evaluator. You
correct.
Tell somebody else who's thinking of putting up the money whether this makes sense or not.
Correct. Or they just want to see, like, how is that funded program doing, mm-hmm. and do we continue to support that mm-hmm. as they submit future grants or... You know, so they can make better decisions about funding, right? And what's great, I think, about the individual who's getting the evaluation done is they have a case, you know, for submitting for additional funding purposes. Like, they can demonstrate.
I thought the funders did that. So if the XYZ Foundation gives somebody money to research something, or the government gives them money, I thought it was their job to figure out whether this proposal made sense. And I thought it was their job to find out whether it's really working.
It is their job,
but
what I'm saying is that also if you wanted to be proactive about it, right, that mm-hmm. individual receiving the funding could otherwise decide to do an evaluation. It's usually not the case, but they could decide to do it because they can better demonstrate to funders that they approach that, hey, we've been really effective in our programs or services.
We got some support for what we're saying.
Well, let me propose a little bit another layer to this, Paul, is that your assumption is that they have in-house capabilities
exactly.
to do that, where
exactly.
in fact maybe they don't, and in fact maybe
their
resources are better spent on other tasks.
Sub it out to somebody who knows what they're doing.
More efficient for them to do it by subbing it out. Plus, go ahead.
So, or the other piece is you can have resources to do it, but you also want another perspective
exactly.
because it has to do with accountability and transparency as well.
And it's an independent evaluation, right?
And it's what do they call it? There's a certain normalcy bias or something. There's something that says if I'm funding something, I'm probably going to look at it and think that it's working anyway, just because.
Right.
I'm vested in its success.
Yes.
So I would say the evolution has been, like, so for instance, a lot of universities and PIs would have someone from another department or school conduct the evaluation. Referred to as an internal evaluation.
Yeah.
But government, for instance, will say that's not good enough, per se. I want to require an external evaluator, right? And therefore, by that requirement taking place, then that PI or professor now needs to go find a firm or an individual who can mm-hmm. conduct an external evaluation.
So the company's been around for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
How widespread is this as far? Because a lot of people, I think, when they look at things specifically like public education and things of that nature and funding, right? The public looks at that and not knowing possibly all the nuances and the layers that go into this in terms of checks and balances.
Yep.
They're looking at it and going, oh, there's just so much waste. But what you're basically, if this in fact is already a widespread standard, if you will, then there's a lot of checks and balances in place
mm-hmm.
that are happening, right? That are trying to safeguard and make sure that there's an impactful, you know, utilization of resources.
Or you could say it should be a widespread use.
So that's my question to you, is how widespread is this? I mean, the company's been around for 10 years. I'm sure it's not the only company in the country that basically provides this kind of service. But how widespread is it?
I would say that a lot of individuals are sole proprietors. Mm-hmm. So a lot of individuals, you know, may have two or three projects themselves. And so the field of evaluation is widespread, and it can be in different arenas. For instance, universities. Areas of focus,
yeah.
Right? Cities, county work, aquariums, for instance, marine centers. So the field itself is widespread.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether or not that particular company is focusing on a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, the majority of our work typically has been with PIs at universities across the country,
right.
Focused on STEM
research. So that's your specialization,
right?
Basically.
Right. And then about 5 or 10% of that is focusing on growth around charitable nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And for charitable nonprofits, I would say the larger, more, I don't want to say sophisticated, but the more
established
nonprofits usually at least are familiar with evaluation, whether or not they've done it or they have their internal team. Mm-hmm. That depends on their resources, but they're more familiar with
and,
it.
And I know that.
And understand why it's effective in receiving, helping them to receive more funding.
Right.
And be able to demonstrate to funders that, hey, the dollars that you've given me, I've done X, Y, Z with it, because we've measured those outcomes and the impact of those outcomes such that, you know, giving money to me versus someone else. Mm-hmm. Like, this is why you'd want to do it.
This is why you should give it to me. Right. No, and two, I will say two things to that. One is I know that you've already lined up, and hopefully we will have somebody call in actually that has been beneficiary of your services.
Mm-hmm.
That will share that as firsthand experience. Secondly, is that I'll go back to this thing with what was appealing to me with the 100 companies who care, and I'll touch a little bit more of that later on after the break on that, but that they actually were evaluating impact. There was an impact award as part of their process, a follow-up, right? So the word impact is critically important, and mm-hmm. to be honest, until I heard it there and I heard it from you, I hadn't really heard it in nonprofits, sitting on a board level, like where evaluating the impact, quantifying the impact, that wasn't part of the conversation that I've been having for the last almost two decades. Paul is signaling me that we actually do have a caller in. So, Paul, do we do?
Yes. Okay, identify yourself. It's that we have somebody here, from Pace University calling to contribute to the conversation. Welcome and identify yourself.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lauren Burney from Pace University. Thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Thank you for joining us, Doctor. I appreciate you calling in. I had asked Tracy if she could figure out somebody who had been first level of, you know, recipient of the benefit of their services to come and share some of the thoughts on that. So I'm glad that you were able to join us. And we were just talking about the importance of having that evaluation, having that quantifiable impact analysis.
And can I ask
you
a question?
A little bit of background on how
and also how do you pick an evaluator? You know, what I'm assuming there are some that are good and some that are bad.
Well, can you share your experience relevant to working together with Tracy?
Certainly, yes. This is a large-scale 14-partner project funded by the National Science Foundation, which focuses on citizen science in New York Harbor, restoring New York Harbor. So we somewhat consider this a signature grant of New York City because of its ability to, you know, have a long reach throughout New York City.
Sure.
And so in choosing a part, you know, somebody that's collaborative, everybody always asks, you know, why did you choose someone on an opposite coast? But it's because of their ability to do exactly what is required. They have extreme knowledge in the field of evaluation. They also have extreme knowledge in the field of research. So combining those two areas, we are able to navigate this world of research and evaluation together with the enormous amount of partnership. So that's why they were chosen. And certainly, you know, in choosing evaluators, you have to choose somebody that's a good fit for the project.
Sure.
And certainly understands STEM education as well as the partnership model.
Well, it sounds like, too, that their capacity was also critical here because of the scale of this project.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you spoke a little bit about impact, and I apologize for missing the beginning of that conversation, but that's what the focus is here, is how do we impact mm-hmm. students, and how do we allow for students to be successful in STEM education? And this particularly when we're working with the largest school district in the United States, New York City Public Schools, the impact is tremendous. Mm-hmm. And so they've been able to quantify that and enumerate that in a way in which it speaks not only to our field, but to the general public. And so citizen science is something that's really becoming notable to the entire United States, whether you're in a rural, suburban, or urban area. And so I think that they've been able to quantify the project and actually really, really do exceptional work in dissemination. We have over 450, you know, publications for the project. We have podcasts, radio shows, TV shows. So they're really, really extraordinary at their work.
Well, and it takes it out of the realm of, you know, sort of the criticism of, you know, the project of this nature is going to have no transparency. It may be, you know, hidden behind the citadels of whatever that are basically, you know, the people that are running this thing. It sounds to me like this actually brings it out into that layman person or anybody who's interested. And there's multiple venues of dissemination of that information in terms of not only what's happening, but also measurable impact. And I agree with you. I mean, and I can only imagine that the resources that are out there that are being thrown on a project like this are something that is critical, especially in a continuously competitive marketplace where there's other things, other projects that are competing for those resources.
Absolutely, and it's particularly with National Science Foundation. You know, the funding is between 4% and 10%, so you're really it's very, very competitive. And so, as you position yourself for such competitiveness, shall we say, it's important to, like you said, create a sense of dissemination in all of these vast areas and also globally. So it's not like we just focus on the United States. It's really a global project, and to speak, you know, so that people in Sydney's Harbor know exactly what's happening in New York Harbor. And we created this digital platform where students can communicate in that way. And we're improving that, and with each phase of this project, it becomes something that has more impact. And that's what we look for in Smart Start, to kind of be able to navigate this with us and tell us what works best and what doesn't work.
You know what I find fascinating, Doctor, is it's interesting. We always talk about the need to have vested interest in the success of something, right? Like whether it's a local community situation or bigger sphere, that having the strategic wherewithal to build into whatever it is that you're putting information out through, the ability for people to feel vested in your success is actually a smart strategy. And in this particular case, especially using new technology and new media, you are able to reach that vested in your success way beyond the borders of New York City and have other people basically also looking forward to this, not only in terms of succeeding, but also how can I learn from it? How can I basically maybe partner and bring the benefits of something like this beyond? So, yeah, and with the current political climate, I don't know that it's only current, but there's always shifts and things that change that impact resources, impact endowments, impact, you know, money set aside for certain things. So when we use the word competitive and we use, you know, things that sound very corporate and maybe not so touchy-feely as a nonprofit should be maybe considered, those are words that are critical. Because at the end of the day, it's still resources that are finite, that are people with genuine, interesting programs are seeking to get funding for. And why should you be the one picked versus somebody else? I mean, I hate to put it that way, but you got to make a case for yourself.
And all are doing good, right? That's the other thing.
Everyone's doing good, but why
so
me? Then
how do you know? How do you distinguish?
Got to ask a question. Well, somebody tweeted in, you're all throwing this term around. I've never heard it before, and apparently our listener didn't either. What is citizen science?
Doctor, would you like to take that? Yeah.
Certainly, yes. So citizen science is involving the community members as part of the process of restoration of New York Harbor. Mm-hmm. And so we do a lot of volunteer outreach. We involve parents of the children of New York City Public Schools. So the more people that you can get involved and ignited in something that's beneficial to a community, the more leverage you have in reaching, you know, a wider range of audience. And so obviously people want clean water in New York Harbor, and so this is something that's always the focus of New Yorkers. So incorporating the actual community members is considered that.
Again, a super smart thing to do from any perspective, because it actually makes them ambassadors, it makes them influencers, it makes them disseminators of information. This is something that is, you know, the average Joe on the street is basically benefiting from, excited about. It takes it, again, like I said, out of this sort of like less ivory citadel of, you know, sort of academia or whatever, and it actually makes it real life positive impact in the community.
And so I was just going to say, so what did Smart Start do for you? Was it, and I'll give you two or three choices, was it simply to evaluate whether this idea worked, or was it to quantify how it worked, or was it to explain that how it worked to others like us?
It's really all three. So the collaboration of the partnership was the dissemination piece, in which they helped to create all of these publications and help share the word of the project. The analysis of the data and research are obviously the central core to the project to make sure that we're speaking to the goals that we said we were going to attain. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the knowledge of the evaluation in general is really important to choose an evaluator that's extremely knowledgeable, and especially with NIH or NSF or or large funders such as these, you have to really be have an understanding of how it's done and what takes place. So
and anticipate needs and anticipate needs probably prior to them becoming critical.
Certainly, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we do a lot of strategic planning in advance. And so when doing a project this large that's required, they're a critical component of that. And so we're learning as we go along. You know, everybody makes mistakes, and we certainly correct those mistakes, and we're better off on the next round.
So can you tell us, our guests, I just want to know, so how did you do those three things? And give us a quick summary. How did you figure out if it's working? How did you quantify that it is working, and here's what it's doing, and how do you, I guess you spread the word through just publications and podcasts like this, but how do you, give us a quick sense of how you do this.
The nuts and bolts.
I'm talking to our guest here, yeah, right.
Well, I think the best...
Talking to Tracy.
Who are we talking to? I think the, I mean, the best way...
He was pointing, but you're
I think
on
the best way to describe it is you're using data, so both quantitative and qualitative information to tell that story, right? So... It's data analysis.
And do you go collect that data, or do you...
It's an ongoing process?
It's an ongoing process, but our job is to collect that data, analyze that data, and report those findings, right?
And
also be able to tell our clients, like, hey, based on what we're seeing, these are the results. This is what we know from other projects that we've worked on with other clients, that this may work, or, like, this is a great way to improve upon it, and or get feedback also from clients like Lauren in terms of... You know, what's working, what's not working, why, and working together, that partnership to figure out what would help us to accomplish a specific goal, you know, more accurately or more effectively. I always like to use effectiveness because that's what you're trying to clearly demonstrate is how effective is something. And I think to give, you know, people a better understanding too, if you go to the Billion Oysters project, and you'll see, you know, in terms of more of the, community impact and what's going on and how it's related more specifically to the individual outside of, you know, research and academia too. So that it's a connection between like university and academia as well as with the general public.
No, I think it's an awesome, that's awesome positive example also to build that into a community, right? In that they see resources and things like academia as a resource.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's sort of a byproduct.
And as part of the community too, because I think sometimes, to your point, like we tend to see research and academia separate from
us.
You know, the individual or family or community or professional, and they're really together, like they're really a partnership between the two. Most of what we have in a commercial environment has started in academia, right? Yeah. And vice versa. So understanding those, you know, that the relationship is key.
So I have a question, Tracy. Okay. We always talk about stuff positively, right? Mm-hmm. And this, I guess, to you too, Doctor. Okay. Is there anything you guys would like to share where there was a challenge? And how you may be basically having the right partners with you along the way made the difference of actually being able to surmount that challenge and actually turn it around. Can you share something relevant to this project that you've had a personal experience in?
Were we a bad partner, Lauren? There's a case where we were bad. We didn't.
I mean, I hate to put you guys on the spot, but sometimes we learn more from those kind of answers.
I think Rod spoke to it really early on, and he said, you know, that you have to have a passion for your work.
Mm-hmm.
And that sings through with projects such as this. So the people that have not been passionate about are not part of the project today. So I think it kind of evolves in and of itself. So people that are here are generally very, very passionate about the project itself and working in collaborative groups and partnerships. And that's something that has to be sustainable long-term in a model such as this.
So would you say that the intensity and the complexity of this structure or infrastructure that you guys have built relevant to the needs of this project, in fact, acted as a weeding out for those who were not really invested in it?
100%.
Yes,
absolutely. And you can sense the intensity of me and my passion for this. So
yeah.
I think, you know, it's a 24/7 operation, you know, and people always laugh, but that's the way New York is and it's nature. So it's really, really exciting. And it's such a feel good project for kids and students in STEM. And so it's just, it's really exciting. And it's just, it's my pleasure to share the word and be a part of it as well.
Yeah. You threw out the million or billion oysters or something. What is that? Is that something that was part of this? And what is that?
The Billion Oyster Project has existed for the last 15 years, and they're putting oysters back into New York Harbor to clean New York Harbor.
Right.
And so they were the hub of this project, in that we wanted to add components that incorporated the educational and academic pieces of for students.
So that's a program that's part of the rehabilitation.
And what did, and so you guys were trying to get kids to go out and put oysters, seed the harbor with oysters?
Yes, so they're doing that, but they're also learning research techniques and STEM tools in order to become active members in STEM careers later on in their life,
get excited
about real science.
Well, and they're hands-on, right? And to a certain extent,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's involving the community, because restaurants can donate their old oysters, right, Lauren?
Right.
And then also, so you build partners with restaurants in New York City.
Oh my God! And you're taking stuff out of the dump too.
So what
is a recycle component?
So they actually, I'm curious, they actually take what? Because I would assume the old oysters are dead or whatever. You're taking the oysters
oyster shells. Yes.
Yeah.
So the oysters need oyster shells to grow on. Fat of oysters need oyster shells to grow on.
So I didn't know that.
From 75 restaurants. Yep.
I'll share a personal experience. Actually, this reminds me very much of, we have a power plant that we refer to lovingly as the Dolly Partons down in South County, which because basically it's protruding like somebody laying on the beach down a nude beach.
But I know it.
You know the Dolly Partons. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So the Dolly Partons actually I think it's an SD. Is it? It's Edison. It's an Edison plant.
It's a combination. It's a two utilities.
Yeah.
Part of
that actually required a lot of mitigation measures.
A lot of
and a lot of stuff that because it literally changed the whole temperature of the water and stuff in San Onofre.
Yeah, they're discharging
water into the ocean. And interestingly enough, part of the mitigation was to actually reforest kelp, right? Because kelp doesn't do well with very hot water. And so basically, there was some damage to the kelp forests off San Clemente and San Onofre. And I remember moving back from Atlanta in 2000, and I actually got involved with Orange County Coast Keepers. Orange County Coast Keepers was doing a test case study of reforestation of kelp, and the test area was actually Crystal Cove. And what we were doing is literally shocking kelp and having these incubators that were in classrooms, in certain classrooms, where we engaged the kids. So it's somewhat similar in a smaller scale, where they were germinating kelp. And then we would basically dive down and implant them into the sand, and it was, inert ceramics with a rubber band, because the kelp basically takes hold, roots into sand. But you need to kind of get it started. Because of the success of that program in Crystal Cove, they then rolled out a major rollout of reforestation of kelp off the coast near San Clemente and San Onofre. And there's a huge, thriving marine ecosystem now with the kelps off there. And then they followed up with the largest artificial reef. Now, we still have, because of the warm water, breeding grounds for great whites now over there.
Maybe that's why.
But we've just rang the dinner bell at the kelp because
there
of all the little fish, right? So now we're definitely not getting rid of the great whites. So, unintended consequences, maybe. But and in the course of doing that, we would take kids out on a boat. And even though it wasn't exactly the kelp that they germinated that we planted, a diver on a microphone with a TV on the boat would talk them through, and they would see fish thriving in this microcosm that they basically helped build as part of a bigger feel-good improvement to the community in which they live. And how many of those kids basically then had the seed planted in them to pursue careers in science as a result of that, and all the ripple effects of that kind of activity.
So that's what Tracy's organization would then try and quantify and measure and report back to the world, that because of this one simple seed that you started, here's everything that sprouted up over time.
Because you can sit there and talk about, it's such a feel-good. And it's going to have such high, far-reaching consequences positively. But in a tightening market for research and funding, and in a changing political environment that's basically prioritizing things differently, we can talk about science, the importance of science all day long, but how do you fund it? And you need somebody like Tracy.
On that point, can I ask both Tracy and the doctor here another question? Is it important when you're creating these projects? I know you're doing it because you want to do it, have a positive impact in the community, and you want to get kids involved and stimulate their brains and get them thinking about science and make them feel like they're involved and the community's involved in these things. It's not just an academic thing. I get all that. Is it also important to try and find some way of building in an economic component? For example, we had waste management in here, and they're talking about how they're capturing methane and other stuff, and they're trying to sell that to fund their good work to try and build sustainable, energy and everything like that. They're trying to sell some of the stuff they're doing. I can imagine these oysters, a certain percentage of them getting harvested back if they're edible, and becoming an economic engine that a positive economic outcome as well as a positive feel good or community.
He gets hungry around lunch.
I love oysters. I love oysters. So I guess I'm thinking to the Oyster Project, did it have an economic harvest component? And is that important to find those if you can and build those in to give one more reason to do this stuff? Hey, it's good for the community. It makes money.
It sure is. And the oysters are not edible because they're filtering dirty water. So
They're not
the ones you want to eat. Maybe that's a little flavor to it. I don't know.
Come to New York. We'll get you some oysters.
But it does have like an economic impact. I mean, think about it in terms of like real estate values, for instance, in Manhattan, right? If your environment or wherever, I mean, this goes for any location around the country, right? But if your environment is not cared for.
Oh, my God, the harbor doesn't stink anymore. Like, my property values just went up. Right.
I mean, there is at some point and in some way an economic tie to what's going on in your community and environment.
Well, right? I'll answer your question.
It may not be now. It could be 50 years from now. At some point,
I think Paul, I don't know what it is, but he went with the answer through his stomach, right?
Which was,
Everyone thinks the same thing. The oysters are.
It was a very primal connection Paul just had with this project. But on a wider, if you will, helicopter view of this, I'll share something to what I was just talking about. By the fact that you have kelp forest now that's thriving off the coast of San Clemente, which is a very well-known surf location, okay, all of a sudden we now have the largest underwater reef that now basically opens up things like fishing, things like scuba diving, things that are tourism-driven things that basically have an economic direct positive impact on the community. So I think, to your point, Paul, yes, that absolutely would make perfect sense, because now anybody who's maybe even resistant to this as being a waste of resources, it's harder for them to negate it, because now there's an actual economic engine development. Exactly. And it may be an economic engine developed in an area that traditionally had a different economic engine that is no longer sustainable. And now you basically added new industry into the area, such as tourism, has a low impact on the environment but has positive impact on
the environment. Here we are in conservative Orange County, and too often I hear the complaint, oh, these are just tree huggers. This is just do-good stuff. We can do without that. And then they say, but, it doesn't just make you feel good, it doesn't just, arguably make life better, but there's some economic benefit to this. If not positive, then it saves you the negative of having to clean it up later here. I mean, one way or another, I think if you can build an economic argument into environmental issues, it only makes it that much harder to refute these things and enlists an even wider group of people who otherwise would say, I don't care about the snail, let them all die.
Well, resources are scarce at some point, right? Always, at some point,
for
right?
For everything, yeah.
And it's whether or not it's here now, whatever the time frame may be, right? So there is always that's why I say, there is always some kind of economic tie to why we do what we do, regardless of what, research, nonprofit, whatever it may be, right? There's a reason we do it.
And then that becomes even more critical, I would think. We kind of talked about this a little bit at lunch before the show, and then we touched on...
Were you eating oysters at lunch? No, probably not. Okay.
And we were eating marine...
We were eating fish.
So, we kept it online.
We didn't ask where the fish came from.
But...
So, Paul, to your point, I'm a native Orange County girl, and so I certainly am excited about being in New York and translating that into components of the work here. And I think when you speak to an economic standpoint of this work, you have to look, we are really long-term looking for sustainability as a learning ecosystem.
Right.
For people to come, researchers to come, scientists to come, and everybody to come and see what we're doing here in New York City. So that is the economic piece.
Well, but Doctor, the other thing too, and again, we kind of touched on it a little bit where I was going with this a few minutes ago, was the sustainability word. okay? We talk about sustainability. It is a word that is rare in nonprofits, from my experience, to talk about things in terms of legacy and sustainability. It's very much a knee-jerk reaction to what the immediate needs are in nonprofits and what you need right now and how to allocate scarce resources to what the immediate needs are, which is really kind of almost a slippery slope. You're constantly chasing your tail, and at the end, you're going to basically trip. But when you start introducing the word sustainability, yes, it has an economic and money-related, meaning, but I think also the passion for this, because right now the appetite for the community, the appetite for the National Endowment, basically look at this thing and go, we really are behind this right now. But then how do you maintain this program over a long period of time if you don't have built into the system these things we are talking about? If it's an afterthought versus a strategic decision from the beginning, because that could really cut the life of your program short past that initial funding. I guess what I'm trying to get out to people is it's important to connect with somebody like Tracy and her organization to make sure that from day one you built into the system these measurable, quantifiable things, not because it's just the right thing to do, but because it's strategically smart to have them in place, because they could really make a difference between you having a program that's sustainable over a long period of time and doing the passion and the mission that is much needed, or you could basically be truncated.
Absolutely. And so that's why the strategic plan at the front end is so important of how you're going to address those issues. And so we have that in place, and Tracy's really helpful in making sure that happens.
So how do they reach Tracy if they want to, if somebody's got some project they want to evaluate it, and how do they find out more about what you guys did in New York with the work that you did?
Doctor, why don't you start us off? How do people find out about the program and just get all excited about it?
Absolutely. I'm at Pace University, and my email is lbirney@pace.edu. It's Dr. Lauren Birney. You can email me, and I'll put you in the right direction with the right contacts. And it's my pleasure being here, and thank you. You guys are really wonderful and very knowledgeable, so it's been a lot of fun.
I'm glad you could join us, Doctor. Have a great day.
Thank you.
And call in any other time you hear interesting topics. Please do. We really would I personally would love to have you guys, whether it's Tracy or you, just chime in every once in a while. Let us know how that program is going, because it's really interesting to see that at that scale.
And ship us some oysters. I'll try eating them. What the heck?
Don't.
Absolutely. We'll have you out here. How about that?
I like that.
I would love to do that, actually. Yes.
We can see the New York Harbor and see the project.
You two are our event.
You are on. Let us know. I would love to do that.
Okay.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Birney.
How do they reach you, Tracy?
Tracy, how do they find
you? You can reach me at tshirachi, so it's tshirachi, at smartstart-er.com. Or feel free and go to the website, and you can call our office through there, too.
What's the website?
It's smartstart, smartstart-er.com.
What's
the ER for?
Evaluation
and research.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Roberts. He's not paying attention. One more time.
Emergency room. Okay.
The bathroom.
I got to go to the bathroom.
And if you forget all of that, you can reach out to me either on The Rad Life on Facebook, or you can drop me an email at Rod, RAAD.Gantus, GHANTOUS, at gmail.com, and I'll connect you with these ladies and anything else that you may have heard on the show that's interesting. I want to hear your comments, your feedback. Want to know that you were listening. And if you are a nonprofit, I'll tell you from personal experience as a person who's sat on many boards, you should reach out and at least find out about the services that Tracy provides. And if you're in the educational sphere, absolutely, because this is something that is only going to benefit your organization, getting you guys pre-qualified, quantifiable, measurable in the impact that you have, that you say you do, but you really don't have a way to really prove it.
Tracy will prove it.
Rolling out new programs, get Tracy on board.
She'll prove it and tell the world about it. Okay.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Can I go to the bathroom now?
Paul, we're going to release Paul to the bathroom.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only octalkradio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.